In your mind, if you have a map, if you remember geography, kind of scrape a little bit of the rust off, think of the Mediterranean Sea, and there at the far end of the sea is Israel, modern Israel. And we've seen the church grow through, and if hopefully I can do this correctly, my geography is poor too, up through what is today Lebanon, Syria, Turkey. Greece, Yugoslavia, and all the way up into Rome, up through the peninsula of Rome. So we've seen the church in just 25 years grow very extensively. Now, in terms of the church at Rome itself, we don't know when it was started or who started it. We have no data that says it could have been perhaps someone who was in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. It could have been travelers, could have been anything else. But we do know that there is people in the city of Rome who are Christians. And Paul is now writing to them. A little broader perspective. At this time, Nero is emperor. When we think of Nero and Christians, what do we normally think about? Pardon? Yep. The city of Rome, while Nero was emperor, was burned, and the Christians were accused. And so, in fact, so in 54 AD, so 3 years before the letter is written, Nero becomes emperor. Very beginning, he was actually a fairly good emperor. Managed the city or managed the empire fairly well. But it's interesting to think about it. From the time the letter is written to the time the Christians are being persecuted is only 7 years. So here when we read this letter, we see the church, a young church, a church that seems to be in at least good reputation. Hopefully that'll stop. But then within 7 years, we see the Christians are made, for lack of a better term, a scapegoat. As was mentioned in 64 AD, the city of Rome had a huge fire. Understand, you have a wooden city, very crowded, very tight. You start a fire in the summer, and it literally destroyed the majority of the city. You need to blame someone. So a convenient group, if you will, were Christians. It's sort of interesting to think about that, about for the Christians that have been blamed where they were standing in society at the time. It was easy and convenient, if you will. They were not viewed very highly. In fact, if you read one of the Roman historians, you realize that Christians were sort of thought as weird. So that's the context of life. That's looking to the future. So here is Paul writing to this church in 57 A.D., and so what I'd like to do is, if you think about the letter, back in the first century, when a letter arrived someplace, typically what was done is it was read to the congregation. People would get together, they would read the letter. So what I want to do is, I'd like to read verses 1 through 15, just as it would have been read in the first century. The only difference is I'll read it in English, not in Greek. So let's read together. It says, Paul, a bondservant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated to the gospel of God, which he promised before through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, concerning his Son Jesus Christ, our Lord, who was born of the seed of David according to the flesh, and declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead. Through him we have received grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among all nations. For his name, among whom you are the called of Jesus Christ. To all who are in Rome, beloved of God, called to be saints. Grace to you and peace from God our Father and our Lord Jesus Christ. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers, making a request, if by some means now at last I may find a way in the will of God to come to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift, so that you may be established, that is, that I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me. Now I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I often planned to come to you, but was hindered until now, that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among the other Gentiles, that I am a debtor both to Greek and to barbarians, both to wise and unwise. So as much as is in me, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome. All right, so that's sort of the introduction of the letter. You think of most letters have an introduction. So let's kind of look at this piece by piece. Let's start with Romans, okay, first seven verses. How does Paul describe himself? So here's this letter coming from Paul. What is Paul's introduction? How does Paul introduce himself? He's a bondservant. Question. What is the difference between a bondservant and a slave? Pardon? Yeah. A bondservant is, as was mentioned, the term we use in American history is indentured servitude. And that is you willingly go into a contract with another person and say, yes, I will serve you. What about a slave? No choice. In Roman society, a slave was property. He was chattel. It was not by choice. Many slaves were political slaves. Many slaves were made slaves. Basically, they were captured people. Your choice was obedience or death. So here Paul introduces himself, says, yes, I am a servant, a bond servant. I choose to put myself in the servitude of Christ. Yes. Exactly. We choose to obey Christ, just like Paul. Paul chose to be a servant of Christ. And as a bondservant, when you're a bondservant, you say, I accept your will. I will do what you ask me to do. So Paul says he's a bondservant of Christ. What else does he say about himself? He's an apostle. What is the significance of an apostle? Yep. Sent out. In fact, the word is ambassador. So Paul is, if you will, in some ways showing his credentials. That here he is, one of the apostles, writing to the church in Rome, a servant of Christ. Now, since he's a servant of Christ, it's interesting how he then, next part of the letter, what does he tell us about Christ or who Christ is? Remember, this is a young church. So sometimes it helps to remind them what they believe in. So in these first seven verses, what does Paul say about Christ? Descendant of David. Why is that important? In fact, why would that be important to a Gentile church? Because most we have here both Jews and Gentiles in this congregation. That the fact that Christ was a living being would be important. Understand Greek philosophy, in fact, we find later in the first century, we call Gnosticism, which is the belief that Christ wasn't really physical. So here we say, here's the lineage, which would be important to the Jews. The fact that he's physical would be important to the Gentiles. What else? Is Paul's writing the promise or is Christ the promise? So we see, Lynn brings up 2 points. One is the fact that Christ, pardon the expression, was no accident. Christ had been prophesied that Christ would come. And also Paul points out the fact that not only was Christ promised, but also there's proof of who Christ is. What's the proof? His resurrection. So here we have Paul establishing who Christ is. Yes, Paul is an ambassador. He's speaking on behalf of Christ. But reminding the people at the church in Rome who they believe in and who Paul is speaking on behalf of. And then he refers to the church in Romans 1:7. What does he call the people at the members of the church in Rome? Saints. What does the word saints mean? Set apart. You think about that. Let me ask a question. Are there saints today? I don't know about you, but I see a bunch of them. It's interesting today that we tend, let me ask a question. Do we tend not to use that word? Why not? Society has, if you will, attempted to redefine that word. And I think in some ways we've allowed society to do that. As we said, saints are simply those that are set apart, those that are consecrated. And you think about that, in that definition and how the Bible uses it. We're the saints. Hopefully we're acting like saints, but hopefully we're the saints. We are the ones that are set apart. We are the ones that are consecrated for the work of God. Yes. Well, again, as look at that term, consecrated, that word saint, would have also been used in pagan society too, because they also have priests and they also have things that are separated for the gods. So really that word that Paul is using is letting know you as the church are separated, but you're separated specifically for the God, not for a God. Good point. But again, we have to, like Jim says, is we have to be careful of the term, but I think on the other hand, we also need to be careful not to not use it. Yep. Yes. So if you didn't hear Nathan, he brought up the point, that word is also translated to mean holy. So that word, Hagenos, sometimes translated as saints, sometimes translated as holy. And again, we as the children of God need to strive to be holy. All right, so we mentioned it's written to the saints at Rome. Let me ask a question. Anything special about the city of Rome in 57 A.D.? Just your average, everyday run-of-the-mill, off to the side of the road town. Pardon? What was the, if you remember some of your history, what was the term used during the Roman Empire for the city of Rome? What was special about the city? All roads lead to Rome. And that was true. You literally can go anywhere in the empire, get on their, if you will, equivalent of 95, and either you went away or guaranteed you went to Rome. Everything, every road, every sea lane, everything, sooner or later would guarantee you to get to Rome. Center of the world. Center of commerce. Good question. I've been thinking about that one. I know that Rome had been 700. Thank you. Eternal city. I think, what was Romulus and Remus? Was that 700 BC? It's Romulus and Remus. Was that 700 BC? No. I'm trying to think when the city was established. In fact, they always claim, you know, magical beginnings of the city. So the eternal city, center of the empire, center of the kingdom, center of the, at one time, center of the republic. It was a republic at one time. So you think about that. So here's the church in this city where all roads lead to. Question. Are there advantages and also disadvantages for a church being in a city like Rome? Let me start with the obvious. What are the advantages to have a church in a city like Rome? Think about that. If you were a member of the church in the city of Rome, it's like an open door. There are people constantly coming to Rome. People have not heard the gospel message yet. So you're in the right place, the right time. Here's an opportunity for you to spread the gospel message and never leave your door. Because the people would come to you. They would be there for a while, they can study with you, and then they could spread the message. So here you are literally at this one point that you can spread the gospel message, since all roads lead out of Rome, to the entire world. Think about it. That's an excellent point Jim made, is if someone says, you know, here's this church, you say, well, I'm, you know, the church is in Jerusalem, the general citizenship of the Empire of Rome would say, Jerusalem, that's where those Jews are out there. That's that sort of oddball religion that believes in only one God. But Jim says, if you're in Rome, there's more legitimacy, saying it's part of the empire. Obviously, if it's in the city, must be part of the empire. All right. What about the disadvantages of being in a city like Rome, the center of commerce? It's true. As was brought out, you may have a lot of opportunities for harvest, but there's very few people there. It's a big city. Now, this is the center of the empire, like I said. The reason why the Roman fire occurred is the city was packed. You had the way people would build buildings, if you had two buildings next to each other, they would build a front and a back. Until literally it was wall-to-wall buildings. That's why when the Roman fire started in 64 AD, it just could not be stopped. Yes? Yes. You think of it, here is Rome, and we've read about the Roman emperors, and it's, pardon the expression, it's a cesspool. Let's be honest, let's put the cards on the table. It's a cesspool. of debauchery, of wickedness, a lot of distractions, a lot of temptations. As I mentioned, Nero was emperor. Prior to Nero was Claudius, Claudius the Stammerer. Nero became emperor. Well, does anyone know how Nero became emperor? His mother poisoned Claudius. Prior to Claudius was the famous or infamous Caligula. We all know Caligula as the guy who elected a horse to the Roman Senate. A guy that, again, in Roman tradition was when the emperor died, they would deify him. Caligula is famous for, he figured, why wait till I'm dead? Deify me now. So he felt he was already a god before he died. He wasn't real popular, so I guess the Praetorian Guard killed him. They got tired of him. So you look at the emperors who are living in the city of Rome, and you look at the moral character of Rome, and you really realize it really is a challenge for the church. So here is the saints who are trying to be holy in a city that makes Las Vegas look like a paradise. So again, those type of disadvantages. Also, too, you think of what other disadvantages of being in a cosmopolitan city? You could always say anything. And think about it. When people came to Rome, they were coming for commerce, typically. Buy, sell, trade. So here are the church trying to teach people. You have to ask the question, how many people were there? You know, they already were there for a reason. Their view is, I'm here to sell, to buy, to leave. And so again, that challenge, that not have time to work with people, can also be a challenge. So we talk about, again, being in the city of Rome has its advantages and disadvantages. And as Josephine says, we have the same challenges today. We live in a, I would say, almost amoral society today, where people's focus is, what's the bottom line? How much? How many? And can I make a profit out of it? So again, same challenge. We as, and you think of it, aren't we similar in some ways? In the sense of, here we are, the minority, in a very large city. And I think Kerry's kind of that way too. We have lots of people that come and go. So we have the advantage of people come to our door to preach that we can teach. But also we have the disadvantages of the distractions. Let me ask another question. So we should talk about Rome and talk about the Church of Rome. Do you think the Church of Rome, the people who were from the Church of Rome, took a little pride in the fact that they were from Rome? Don't we all take a little pride in, like, our hometown? I can't for mine. Mine has become infamous because there was a TV series where the town I was born in, on the TV series, the town is famous for a strip joint. So it keeps me humble. But you think about it. So you think of the people of Rome would take some pride. Had Paul been to the church at Rome yet? No. But he even says he longs to do it. Had Paul been to other churches? Remember, this is about 57 AD. And as I mentioned, this is written, most historians believe, 57 AD, Paul was wintering in the city of Corinth on Paul's third missionary journey. So Paul had already been, if you will, to some cities, to help establish a church. But it hadn't been to Rome yet. So do you think the Romans might have felt, you know, Paul, you've been to these other cities. How come you haven't been here yet? Do you think that perhaps that there might have been some of that feeling? I don't know about you, but sometimes you ever go visit your relatives? And it doesn't matter how far away it could be. It could be 3 hours, 12 hours, 5 day journey. You go visit your relatives, and there could be one relative that lives 10 minutes away. And unless you specifically go to their house, they're upset that you didn't come and visit them. Has that ever happened to you? Ever had that experience? They say, well, you didn't come visit me. Yeah, I drove 2,000 miles. Couldn't you go 10 minutes? Oh, no, no, you had to come to my house. You know where I am. I don't know where you are. Oh, no, it doesn't matter. Is that human nature? So you have to wonder if perhaps the church at Rome was, Paul, how come you haven't come here? How come you know, we're Rome. Why aren't you here? What's Paul's answer to that? What does Paul tell them in verses 8 through 13? Think about that. First of all, Paul says, yeah, no, I haven't been here, but I'm always praying for you. In fact, he even says, God is my witness. You are always, always in my prayer. What else does he say? Yeah, he says, I want to come here. I've wanted to come here, but how come he hasn't? So, yeah, he even says he's been hindered. Verse 13 says, but I was hindered until now. Yes. Think about that compliment. Think about, that says a lot about the church of Rome. Where he says, you know, I hear about you. Your faith is told about throughout the world. And again, this church, we don't know a lot about it yet. We know as we read the letter, there obviously is both Gentiles and Jews in the church. But think about that. To have a church that's fairly young, and yet, as Paul says, throughout the world, I hear about you. And obviously hear good things about you. So Paul's telling them, again, that respect. The fact that, yes, you're sort of, in regards to Paul, you're sort of out, you know, out west. But I hear about you, yes. Kathy made a good point, is Paul is saying you're not forgotten. Not only are you not forgotten, but like he says, one is I'm praying for you all the time, and I also hear about you. You know, you as a church, people hear about you. So yes, Paul has not visited them yet, but there are people that know about you, and positive things too. And he reminds them. He says, I want to come to you. I want to be there. And for what reason? Isn't that wonderful? Where Paul is saying, it's not only your benefit that I come to be with you, but it's also my benefit as well. Do we ever consider the mutual benefit we have as Christians when we come together? We encourage each other by simply being together. We strengthen each other. We in some way complement each other. There's that strength of knowing there's others that have this, who are of like precious faith. Again, Kathy brought that point out. If you think of it, we as members of the church, yes, we're members of this congregation, but we're also members of Christ's church. I find it interesting when I travel, or I used to travel, is one time I was in Rochester, Minnesota for 8 weeks. And I had been there, I guess, maybe 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks. And I come into work, and someone was asking me, well, so what did you do this weekend? And I told him, I said, well, I went to have dinner with people from this church, from the church. And they're like, what? I said, yeah. I said, the members of the church knew that I was in town by myself, and so this older couple invited me to dinner. The people at work could not imagine how here I am to them, this total stranger, where in less than 3 weeks, there's these people that are inviting me to dinner. They're like, you crazy? These people crazy? You're a stranger. I said, no, I'm not. But again, it's that bond of friendship. It's that common bond of Christianity. If you didn't hear Nathan, he mentions the fact that there were people at the church, you know, from the end of the letter, that he knows. Aquila and Priscilla are some. And he mentioned also, took us back to history, is the church had apparently suffered some persecution before because Aquila and Priscilla had been cast out of Rome, and now they're back. Yes. That's, you brought up a good point of, again, Paul saying, I want to give you something. And as you mentioned, spiritual gift, most translators believe that is, as you said, a miraculous gift. Because think about it is, again, church is still young. In fact, New Testament is still being written. So how does the church ensure the purity of the message? And part of that is through the miraculous gifts of knowledge. So Paul could go there, find someone, lay his hands on them, and again, help them with miraculous knowledge. Again, helping to, as he says, establish that church. Because, let's be honest, we're all humans. Sometimes we make mistakes and confusion. So the intent with that would be to help the church be sure that it stayed pure. That here was the truth, complete and unadulterated. So again, that gift, in fact, perhaps that was also one of the things that the Romans might have felt slighted of saying, well, Paul, you're going to these other churches, giving them these gifts. You know, we're Rome. Aren't you going to give us something? And especially as it was mentioned, their impact. How much better to help guarantee the quality of the message than through a miraculous gift? And it gets back to, again, the purpose of miraculous gifts was to ensure the truth and accuracy of the message. That was, as we study scriptures, we need to keep that focus of why were the miraculous gifts. And that was, again, it always gets back to the message. That's the purpose of the gift. And also, again, in verse 13 says, that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among other Gentiles. I am a debtor both to Greek and to barbarians, both to wise and unwise. How is Paul a debtor? When you think about it, here's Paul saying, I want to come to you, I want to give you a gift, but now he's saying he's a debtor. Pardon? But again, it says, I, Paul, am a debtor also to Greek and to barbarians, both to wise and unwise. No, he's indebted to them. The Greek is, he's indebted to them. Right. But again, if you think about it with Paul, what he's saying here is, no Christians in Ireland. We need each other. Paul is saying, wasn't Greeks and barbarians that help him on his journeys? Don't we as Christians help each other? You know, Paul is not saying that I did it all by myself. He's saying, I count on Christians just as you are counting on me to help you. Again, that bond. So as you read this letter, you realize the more we read it, you know, Paul, although a teacher, although an apostle, Paul is also a Christian. In that regard, just like us, are equal. And in verse 15, so as much as in me, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome also. So you think about, here's Paul saying, I want to talk to you. I want to teach you. I want you, and of course, as we go through this quarter, we'll see the message that Paul brings. A lot of people will point to the book of Romans, if you look at some people through history, as being a paramount book in their life because of the clarity and truth of the message and the logic and explanation of the nature of God and the nature of the church. There are a number of, like I said, historically significant people who have said, this was the paramount book. This is the book that literally lays it out. And you think about it, when you read this book, was there a problem, or was there a serious problem in Rome when this book was written? But not really. I mean, there were some, again, issues between the Jews and the Gentiles, but really, this is really a doctrinal book. When you look at some of the other letters that Paul writes, church in Corinth, other churches, he's dealing with specific problems. But here, really, he simply is laying down that foundation, the foundation of what the gospel is, what faith is. Good point. And again, you think about it too, as I brought up, 7 years after this is written is when the Christians will be persecuted in Rome. And think about it, when we talk about persecution of the Christians, we're talking about being butchered by wild animals, being basically put on stakes, covered with oil, and used to light the night. So from the time this letter is written to the time, you know, 7 years later, the church is about to face significant persecution. And you think about why is how the world was beginning to view Christians. And it's interesting because, again, when you read the histories, it wasn't because they were evil. It's because Christians were different. Because Christians took a stand. Exactly. Rome was a cross-section of the world population. You had people that were highly educated to probably people that could not read or write. You had people that were of society, to people that were bond servants, to people that were slaves. fact, just a little off the wall, just real quick, the word barbarian. The word barbarian comes from, in fact, from Roman times, because they would say, hear these people, because they didn't speak Greek. So all they do is go, bar, bar, bar. That's where the word barbarian comes from. And yet, Paul says, I'm indebted to those people, because those are the people that help the church grow. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
You know, it's I've heard it postulated because of some years before that Will and Priscilla were there. You know, it appears that they probably or may have been converted by Paul, because it just says mm-hmm. Jews from Rome, yep. You know, at the time. And, you know, that when they returned, that they may have been the very seedbed mm-hmm. there for Christianity. I mean, because obviously they were teachers.
Yep.
I mean, they took hold of
Apollos.
way more accurately. So, and they very well may have had mm-hmm. Paul's hands laid on them, which would have made them qualified and capable yep. of teaching and mm-hmm. establishing a church. Because mm-hmm. they're the first ones. You know, he's yep. right out of the gate when he's doing his final farewells.
Yep.
Bill and Priscilla, they literally laid their lives on the line for me. You know, I mean, a very high praise. Yep. So you just wonder if that's maybe the source of this church.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, you have somebody there able to teach, but that's one he needed to go.
Yep.
Because my apostle obviously had not.